Today is June 26, 2019, and this is episode number 517 of the Apple Context Machine. It's a podcast for the Mac Observer. I am Brian Chaffin, editor-in-chief TMO, and though I had to check, I can confirm that Cheese Whiz does actually have dairy in it. It also has Worcestershire sauce in it. Who knew that, right?
Who knew?
Also, it is delicious. I'm not talking to you yet, sir. Also,
just
it is
to
delicious
shut me up.
On a Philly. Good luck with that. The Philly cheesesteak. Yeah. It's like, yeah, John. Okay, fine. You've messed me up. Have you had a Philly cheesesteak with Cheese Whiz on it?
No, but I've been in Philadelphia on business, and I had a real Philadelphia cheesecake with garlic.
And cheesecake or cheesesteak?
Cheesesteak.
Okay. Yeah.
It was awesome. The taste was in my mouth for days.
Hopefully that was a good thing. To get the full story on anything we cover in this podcast, you can visit macobserver.com/ACM. And if you'd like to comment on or question anything about the show, join me over at macobserver.com/contextmachine, and that'll take you straight to our Facebook group. Now, today I am recording from an Airbnb in Philly. Vacation starts tomorrow. As a matter of fact, I'll just let you know now, there won't be a show next week, the week of July 4th, but I will be coming back the week after that. And I am joined today by the
Indomitable.
Yes.
Lovable.
Infuriating, right? John Martellaro.
Pleased to be here.
Yeah,
just
thanks
try to shut me up.
It doesn't really...
doesn't
really seem possible at all. No, man, I appreciate you doing the show this week. We have a couple of, I think, interesting topics. Just jumping right into it, John. This is something that Dave Hamilton put in my head, and I haven't written it yet, and I probably won't write it until after I get back from vacation, which means I won't write it until after I get back from vacation. But a lot of people criticize Apple for seeming to no longer be skating to the puck, which is something that Apple did really well under Steve Jobs. And it sometimes seems that Apple isn't, I completely disagree with that, John. I'm just going to interrupt myself. There are two areas, and this was Dave. The first one is Dave Hamilton's point, which was that when it comes to privacy, Apple has indeed been skating to the puck and hasn't been given any credit for it.
I agree.
But I would also add that Apple has been skating to the puck with recycling and augmented reality. I think Apple has
solar power.
Yeah, but that's
being energy independent.
That's its own. That's internal.
Yeah, but that's good for the planet.
Well, no, it is good to the planet, but in terms of its product line, I think really that's where people are most concerned about skating to the puck.
Yeah, that's true.
And I think that Apple is way ahead on augmented reality and is absolutely skating to the puck. But the biggest thing is privacy, which has been a top concern seemingly since shortly after Tim Cook took over from the late Steve Jobs.
And one of the things that we were talking about before the show started was that in my recollection, and I've been there since the Apple II days and followed Apple and writing about Apple since 1997-98, is that this concept of privacy was not baked into Apple's DNA from square one. In the early days, Apple was all about the usability of the Apple II and bringing personal computing into the home. And that evolved.
Well, wait, that was Woz. That was Woz's obsession. That wasn't
Steve wanted
everything closed.
Yeah, I'm not talking about closed or open. I'm just talking about Steve's marketing concept and seizing on the business opportunity. If Woz had been left to his own devices, Apple would have sold maybe, 5,000 Apple IIs and it would have died. Steve Jobs was the marketing mind.
Yeah.
He saw the business opportunity behind putting a personal computer into the home, and he had a certain feeling about how it ought to look. You know, you can't have the owner of it assembling their own power supply and using a hex keypad. It had to be some semblance of a typewriter and a closed system that was easy to use and yet still had slots, which was required in those days. But the point is that as Steve Jobs evolved as the CEO of Apple, there was this concept of the elegance of design, the enabling factor of the tool that allows creative people to use a tool to create great things. And that was the origins of the Think Different campaign, being creative and being effective user of your tools, and the tools create for you a great environment. It wasn't until the internet really started taking hold and backdoors started being built into applications and everything you did on the internet was being monitored and tracked and watched, that Apple leveraged off of their heritage of "we only build the best" to this concept of, well, if your tool is going to work for you, then it has to protect you. And then the privacy idea was spawned, and as you said, with Tim Cook. So it wasn't baked into Apple's, it wasn't baked into Apple's DNA. It was a natural outflow of Apple's values.
Yeah, I would agree with that. But there, I think I'm going to add a layer to this that – I don't know. Anyway, I'm just going to add a layer to this. First of all, we don't actually know whether or not Steve cared about privacy, because it really wasn't an issue.
That's right.
It wasn't an issue when Steve was with us. It certainly, I think it was starting to become an issue in the last year or so of his life, but he was super busy with Apple University. He was super busy with making sure that Apple survived him. He was super busy trying to survive on a day-to-day basis and still run a company. But here's my added layer. I think that it is conceivable that Tim Cook's homosexuality has a lot to do with his interest in privacy, from the standpoint of he may well be aware of the kinds of issues that could come out of a person's life not being private. Going back to LGBT issues, LGBTQ issues are still in flux and still getting a lot of pushback from you know, an aging conservative rear guard. But if you go back to when Tim Cook was young, and remember, Tim Cook only came out a few years ago. It wasn't that long ago at all. And being outed, right, having your privacy invaded could affect your career, could affect your family, could affect your life.
You know, I do a lot of reading on the internet, and I've never seen anybody brave enough to flesh out that concept. I hope that's part of your article when you get back from vacation, because I think that's an important observation.
Well, you know, this, I don't have any. I didn't even think about it until we started working on the show, John.
It's a great observation.
Well, thank you. I wonder. I mean, because it's not like he's never made that argument publicly. I have zero proof. It's only an observation about society, about, you know, about almost more of an observation about society than it is specifically about Tim Cook.
Well, I think it's interesting in contrast to the conventional comparison, because if you ask somebody on the street that same question, they would have said that Apple builds great hardware and in exchange for your dollars, they deliver to you metal of some kind, gloriously smooth aluminum that does wonderful things. And so there's a quid pro quo. You pay Apple money, they deliver you this glorious device that is the best of breed and allows you to fulfill your best aspirations as a creative and technical person. And so there's no need to supplement their income because Apple already has a good profit margin. It's those companies that sprung up like Facebook and Google, which don't deliver massive amounts of great hardware to the customers, who had to find some other way to make money. And we were all amazed in the early days, you know, when Google was, you know, created Gmail, we thought, oh, wow, this is a great gift. Isn't it nice of Google to give us free email? Maybe that's just maybe their way of thanking the community. Then later we found out what they were doing with our mail. So these companies that don't have the quality products that Apple does have to figure out a way to make money. And I think that would have been the normal explanation. And it still is probably 50 to 60% of the discussion of why Apple's focusing on privacy. They don't need to worry about
a
different business model.
Tim Cook has said, for years he has said that he thought that one day privacy would become a competitive advantage. And it may well be that's the only issue.
You know why it's a competitive issue? Just because people don't really understand what's happening to their systems. They don't understand what happens when they use Facebook, when they click on a link, or that when they sign in with their Facebook credentials to some other place. Everything has been designed to be deceptive and to be secret and to look innocent and operate in the way it operated 20 years ago. Everything looks the same. Your browser looks the same. You enter a URL, you go to a page, just like it did in the old days. But there's this infinite amount of tracking and activity that's going on behind the scenes. People don't have a technical understanding of what's happening there. And so what you have to do is you have to tell them, remember, privacy is important. Privacy matters to you, doesn't it? Don't you want to keep your data private? And so it's a marketing angle that gets at the problem.
Yeah, it is. And it may be no more than that. Or it may be... I apologize to anyone who is hearing a little noise in the background. Needs must when the devil drives. All of Apple's focus on privacy may well be opportunistic. I think pre-show, John, you mentioned that you think that Apple sort of backed into it. I don't actually think that's the case. As a matter of fact, John, it's because you said that made me think about Tim's background and why it may be important to him. I don't think Apple backed into it.
When I say they backed into it, what I mean is that it wasn't part of Apple's culture before it became an issue on the internet. And then Apple's values as a company, plus Tim Cook's perspectives as an individual, came into play, and he skated to where the puck was going to be, and that is appreciation of privacy that Apple delivers to you, confidence in the product.
Yeah, confidence in the product. Regardless, like there are so many decisions that Apple seems to have been making in the last. For many years now, that put user privacy at the forefront, and in many ways, in ways that the users aren't even aware of, like storing our fingerprints back when Touch ID was a thing, right? Storing our fingerprints on the device instead of on Apple servers.
In the secure enclave. Yeah.
In the secure enclave. That's huge. That's huge. Using differential privacy. Wait, differential. What is it called? Differential. The system they were using to send information to their servers for the AIs to learn while keeping it essentially meaningless in terms of identifying anybody.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
I think it's differential privacy.
Could be.
If only there was kind of a way. Differential privacy. Yeah, it's differential privacy. Yeah. From using differential privacy in teaching their AIs, from building end-to-end encryption into iMessage, and building end-to-end encryption in FaceTime, like all of these things, John, put user privacy front and center in ways that in many cases users weren't even asking for yet. And if that's not skating to the puck, I don't know what it is.
Well, I think Apple engineers are very aware of the threats, and they are able to analyze and observe in hacking attempts and the effects that have on their systems, and they can study various techniques, and they understand what technical measures need to be done to protect the machine. And because of the focus on privacy, they take very intelligent, proactive measures to protect the system. I imagine that at other companies, the measures that would be required to protect the user would conflict with the business model. Somebody would sit down and say, well, if we protect the user from this flow of information, we won't be able to access it and sell it to our business partners. And so in other companies, there's a conflict of interest. You know, at Apple, there isn't. Their motives are just outright, you know, protect the user. And that gives Apple, based on its knowledge and perspectives about the industry, a sort of a green light to you know, go to the absolute lengths that they need to go to protect the user. There's no compromise, no business model conflicts, you know, driven by corporate agenda and all that. And that's nice. And I think, again, when Tim Cook says, you know, we're protecting your privacy, he that's just a label, you know, that he says, you can trust us. You can have confidence in these products that you buy. Whereas with, say, something like Facebook, there is this allure. There is this psychological attraction. There is the idea of followers. There is the idea of connecting with people. There's the idea of sharing your photos. There's the idea of communicating with people, and it's all free. So the emotional and psychological lure of a free product ropes customers in. You don't have to sell them on the integrity of the system. You don't even have to bother, because they're going to do what they're going to do anyway. If consumers really understood what was going on at Facebook, instead of having 2 billion followers, they'd have 200.
True that. And I think that the reality is that we are starting to see privacy as a competitive advantage for Apple. It's still not anywhere near as much as it should be. I mean, like, no one should buy Android devices, and no one should be like on Facebook, and that includes me, and I am on Facebook, and, you know, no one should be on Twitter. No one should be doing any of those things that are in the surveillance capitalist system. Surely there is at least an increase in privacy being an issue. You know, here's another thing, John. As much as Apple has been skating to the puck on privacy behind the scenes, it sure seems like Apple could be doing a better job of educating the public and educating government regulators and educating politicians, educating all of us on the importance of privacy, on the importance of not only privacy from the government, but privacy, which is, you know, enshrined in a little document I like to call the Constitution. Oh, I'm going to go see that this week. Is there a copy of the Constitution in Philadelphia? Do you know?
I don't know.
I'm going to find out. It's been super busy so far. Anyway, the point is that I wish Apple would do a more proactive and out front job of making the case for privacy and why it's important from protecting us against foreign governments that are wanting to steal our information and criminal organizations that are wanting to steal our information and why these things are important.
Well, one of the things that I've noticed is that we talked about this on TDO recently with Kelly, is that Tim Cook already has the ear of the president. And so why bother with lobby money? It turns out Apple has spent $2 million in 2018 lobbying the government. Compare that.
Well, hold on, 21. It's $2 million in 2019. It was $6.7 million in 2018, which is a lot more than it used to be. And it was even more in 2017. And 2017 was a pretty sharp increase from, I think, $4.5 million in 2016. But it's $2 million so far this year.
I think that communicating the issues of privacy to the president are hard to get transmitted onward to congressional staff, whereas communicating the business interests of Apple when it comes to business in China and the effects of tariffs are more effective things that Tim Cook communicates. So
there is zero chance that Tim Cook was talking about privacy with Donald Trump.
Right.
Chance that was an issue, that's what they were talking about.
And the problem right now, as I see it, is that when Apple spends its money trying to educate congressional staffers about the effects of loss of security on your phone and the potential problems with back doors, that is drowned out by the voice of the law enforcement community that say, well, we can, perhaps with a little arrogance, we are the only ones that can get in, and those keys will be protected, and all will be great, and we'll be able to do our law enforcement as usual by getting into these phones. So there is this sort of lack of technical understanding combined with tremendous motivation.
Well, that's why I think it's important for Apple to be making the case publicly, not just to congressional staffers, not just to regulators, to the president.
That's a very delicate issue to come out and say, we're Apple, we're going to fight law enforcement.
Well, that's what they wouldn't do that. But you could put... You could have documents on.
Oh yeah, people are going to read those. Yeah, right.
You never know. Like the why we think privacy is important.
It has to be juicy. It has to be thrown out there with panache and simplicity and charm.
Come on, John. You can do something. Are you telling me, John?
That's why companies have jingles. Is because they can't convey the quality of their product in technical terms, so they create these jingles that go round and round in your brain.
John, are you telling me that because Apple can't come up with a jingle for privacy, they should do nothing?
Well,
is ridiculous.
Well, Apple struggled for years to try to convey the benefits of Mac OS X back when it was called that, compared to Windows. And they really, it was the time when I was with Apple, and I had some ideas that didn't go anywhere and weren't listened to. And I could see Apple struggling with how to convey in a 30-second TV ad the qualities of Mac OS X, what made it different from Mac OS 9, what made it better than Windows. You can't do that in 30-second commercial. But finally, they came out with it. I'm a PC, I'm a Mac, a very successful campaign. But it took years to come up with that.
Okay, there is YouTube. The difference between Apple then and Apple today is they've got all the money. They did not have all of the money when they were doing I'm a Mac. There's YouTube, there is Twitter, there is Apple's own site,
lots
which is
of
one
money.
Of the busiest
lots
sites.
Of money doesn't buy you a brilliant marketing campaign. Only brilliant marketers can do that.
Okay, but that's what you hire. God, you're infuriating me. You're telling me
buy success
that Apple shouldn't do anything because they may be having difficulty doing something. That doesn't make any sense. Do something and try. Be more upfront about it. Talk more. Spend some of that keynote time talking about why privacy is important.
Maybe they should come up with a new campaign with John Hodgman. I'm a PC, I'm a hacker. I don't think it has to be a hacker.
I don't think it has to be a commercial campaign. There are a million different ways to deliver information.
Yeah, but this message is so delicate and so important and so in need of attractive, compelling argument to overcome. If you're gonna convince people that law enforcement's argument that they should have access to every phone through a back door is dangerous for our democracy and for our privacy and security, you've got to do something brilliant.
Okay, but that doesn't have to be the argument either. Doesn't have to be Apple against law enforcement. Doesn't have to be the people versus law enforcement. The message instead can be the importance of privacy and what privacy means and who are the actors that are known to be going after information and why things like end-to-end encryption are the only way to adequately protect ourselves from those parties.
Well, that's a delicate issue because people are already pre-programmed to understand that under certain circumstances their privacy is given up. If the government suspects somebody of a crime,
I know a company who's really good at messaging. Apple.
Yeah, but
so they could they so I, what I'm saying is that I want to see some of that effort turned to making that case. If Apple wants privacy to be a competitive advantage, like I mean, sometimes I wonder if Apple is just kind of hoping that they could just sort of keep skating under the radar, doing everything like you know on the down low when it comes to privacy, and that you know they won't ever actually have to have a big confrontation on it. And I don't think that's the case. And I think that Apple should work ahead of time to get the public on its side on this issue, so that the next time we have a major terrorist event or, you know, a baby kidnapped or, you know, murder evidence on a locked iPhone, that Apple can have that message out there before people are instead outraged by Apple, you know, being seen as helping the bad guys.
And you're going to do this to people who think the Earth is flat and the moon landings were fake.
Okay, that's a tiny percentage of the people. What are you talking about?
Or who think their kids shouldn't be vaccinated.
That's also a tiny percentage of the population.
Percentage. It's an unfortunate percentage enough to cause a pretty serious nationwide epidemic. I'm just saying that you have to be very careful about these messages and how you convey them to people and get them to listen.
Okay, but not messaging is not being careful about messaging. Right? Not messaging is not being careful. Not messaging is just not messaging.
Well, this technical issue.
I want more messaging. Why are you even arguing with me on this?
Well, because I don't think people really understand.
That's Apple's job. Make us understand. That's what I'm saying. I want Apple to make us understand.
I think it's too difficult a concept to explain to people about encrypted keys and backdoors.
Yes, you're right. Might as well not even try. You might as well not even try. Good point.
I agree.
It's difficult.
Well,
it's really hard.
Well,
might as well
Apple,
not even
Apple
try.
Hasn't
might as
tried.
Well not do anything. As a matter of fact, everything is hard, so why try anything?
I stand my ground. I think it's a very hard thing to do. It would require a new and brilliant marketing campaign.
Great, do that. And I don't even think it has to be a marketing campaign. It can be an educational campaign. It can be about offering information to people. It can be about talking to reporters. It can be about holding seminars. Apple could do in the Apple stores. Apple could do Apple and privacy, or why privacy should be important to you or is important to you, or how Apple is protecting your privacy. They could do sessions like that in their Apple stores. It would be attended by people.
But eventually, the problem is eventually in this communication that you have to come up with, you have to face the issue that you are at odds with the desire of law enforcement to have access to your phone
for law enforcement will be educated
purposes.
Law enforcement will be educated along with the rest of the people.
But it's such a polarized society. It's hard to get a lot of people on board with a single idea and concept. Everybody appreciates their privacy. That commercial, that brilliant commercial that Apple recently ran about all the different scenarios of privacy. You know, people slamming doors, people in the bathroom want their privacy, people at work want their privacy. A brilliant series of little vignettes that gives examples of why people appreciate their privacy. But try to do that in terms of saying, well, okay, we're gonna resist the outcries of law enforcement because your privacy is more important than the law.
That's not the messaging. That's not the messaging, and it's not that or nothing. There's different ways to message that, starting with simply talking about the importance of privacy. You don't have to pit yourself against law enforcement.
Well, Apple's, like I said, Apple's done a brilliant commercial to punctuate that, and I praised it in print. And Apple put some effort into that commercial.
I accept your apology. They should, in fact, do more of those commercials. I see that you come full circle and now understand the importance of what I'm saying.
But those commercials by Apple are focusing on privacy in abstract, in isolation. There's no nuance of the delicacy of the needs of law enforcement versus individual privacy.
So again, those are commercials. Those are commercials.
Well, I look forward to your marketing campaign, Brian.
I'm not sure. Listen, man, the last thing I'm going to say is that I'm better at marketing than Apple. Apple is the company to do this. Apple is the company to deliver this message. Apple is the company to explain why having a device. Okay, check this out, John. I have a friend, and this friend is like super pro Samsung. Samsung is awesome and Apple sucks and is terrible. Like Android is the bee's knees and Samsung is great, blah, blah. It just drives me nuts. And one day he complained to me, John. He complained to me. He said, I can't remember exactly how we worded it, but it was either like how wrong it was or how frustrating it was or even how terrible it was, what a bad thing it was that he would get advertising based on his searches, right? He would like search for something and then he'd be seeing advertising for that later, right? And we're communicating over a text message at this point. And I said, well, it's a good thing that your platform of choice is predicated on this, right? This thing that you're complaining about, the platform that you think is so awesome is predicated on this thing that you were complaining about. And he's like, well, what do you mean? It's like, well, Android is designed to slurp up all your information so they can sell you advertising. It's what it does. And I said, you know, there's only one platform out there that is trying to protect your privacy and is not trying to profit off of your information. And he goes like, oh, no, all the platforms are the same. It's like, what? What do you, and like, he was just, I mean, I felt like I was arguing with the flat earther, to be honest. He's a buddy of mine. God bless him. For the first time, I felt like I was arguing with the flat earther because like the facts had no bearing whatsoever on his case. In his mind, all the platforms are trying to steal your information.
Well, that's a problem.
Trying to sell it.
We were talking about before about educating the population. Being educated, and I see this with my wife as a college professor trying to educate young people. When you're in a beginning programming class, say Python, you don't have a lot of context. You don't have familiarity with the terminal window, with the ins and outs of the machines, with ASCII. You don't have familiarity with college algebra. You don't have familiarity with physics and equations. You don't have familiarity with problem solving and algorithms. All of a sudden, you're confronted with a lot of information at once that it's hard to absorb and hard to put into context. And to be a successful programmer, you have to put a lot of things together. You have to understand precedence of equations. You have to understand problem solving. You have to understand loops. You have to understand how your machine operates. You have to understand, you know, that it's base 2 system and the numbers that look like 2.0 are really 1.99999 underneath. And that comes into play sometimes in your comparison test. There's all this context and all this technical understanding that goes into finally being able to write, you know, 25 lines of Python code and make it work and give the right answer. So the process of education in the public is the same way. You have people who are not technically trained. They know how to tap their phone and make a phone call, and they know how to surf the net, and they know how to buy on Amazon by tapping and touching. But trying to educate them about some technical issues requires them to bring to the table context and understanding. I see this talking to people about aerospace. I see this talking to people about physics and science. They're just completely lacking perspective because they haven't served in the military. They haven't had a technical degree in their past. And they just can't put into perspective what it is you're trying to tell them. And so they can't draw logical conclusions that stick. And that's what happened to your friend. Your friend wasn't immersed in the technology, wasn't well-read, and he didn't have a technical basis. He didn't grow up with the Apple II and the Mac, and he didn't have, you know, 30 years of experience programming or understanding the ins and outs of development and how apps actually work and how they launch. He just knows that it's, you know, it's got a home page and it's got icons and you tap them. And that's why he was thinking that everything's the same. And so when you're trying to educate people about certain things, you have to connect with them on the basis on which they have a technical understanding. And that Apple ad we were talking about privacy in the bathroom, everybody understands that. That's pretty obvious. Apple picked some very obvious human and personal aspects of privacy. But trying to translate that over to a very complex technical machine doing hundreds of billions of calculations per second in a sophisticated operating system like iOS is beyond approach. So you're going to have different people having different perspectives about the situation, and so they're just going to be arguing with you.
Yeah, I suppose that's a possibility. That is. I'm certainly used to having people argue with me, especially one John Martellaro. He likes to argue with me. All right, speaking John Martellaro of arguments, you had some thoughts on Disney Plus.
Yeah, the other day I did some research. I owe it to Andrew Orr, who found an article from the New York Post that talked about how Apple was designing its original content stuff to, you know, be attractive to the Academy Awards, and to win Oscars and to be high quality content. But buried within that article was an interesting comment about how Apple's sort of at odds with the other services. There's a sort of implied value you get from your subscription fee. If you pay $12 to $14 a month, depending on what plan you have with Netflix, you know that you have access to hundreds of original content shows. You have access to thousands of movies and TV shows. And you make a mental estimation of what the value of the service is worth. And same thing with Hulu and Amazon Prime and so on. And so Disney comes out with an announcement a few weeks ago about Disney Plus launching November 12th in the United States. How you're going to have access to the...
Long expected.
Yeah, you're going to have access to the Disney content, access to Lucasfilm, access to Marvel, access to Pixar, and access to National Geographic content. And you're going to pay $6.99 a month. All of a sudden, it blows up Apple's value and price proposition, because we had watched Apple come out with Apple Music at $10 a month. We saw Apple come out with Apple News Plus at $10 a month. Apple Arcade hasn't been announced, but most people expect that to be $10 a month as well. And you might surmise that Apple was thinking that video, television, and movie content would be worth a little bit more than Apple Music, because feature-length films are more valuable and more extensive and more expensive to make than songs for a dollar each. So you might submit that Apple would try to sell Apple TV Plus at $12 a month. And all of a sudden...
Yeah,
go ahead.
My estimate was that it would be at least as much as Apple Music and probably more.
Yeah.
That was what I was arguing.
Right. And so now Disney comes out with $6.99 a month for all this content. And so all of a sudden Apple's blown out of the water in its price and value proposition. And so the New York Times article pointed out that reliable sources from Apple said that Apple was shopping around for a movie and TV library. And one of the predictions was from Variety that Apple was looking hard at Sony Pictures as a possible acquisition candidate. Because if you're going to charge people $10 a month, you can't tell them, well, we only have 30 shows in production and maybe there's 5 or 6 new ones that are available to you now on launch day. And people go, what, $12 a month for 6 shows when I can get thousands of shows from Netflix? Not a good subscription choice. So Apple's going to have to think about maybe a long free trial period, which we have discussed before and we disagreed on. And Apple's going to have to think about acquiring a big library, like maybe Sony Pictures. And Apple's going to have to think about maybe even disguising and burying the monthly fee in a bundle so that you don't really realize that how much you're paying for Apple TV Plus. Because if you throw it in a bundle with News Plus and Arcade Plus, Apple Arcade and Apple Music can pay $39 a month. The value of Apple TV, which appears to be thrown in for free, kind of gets buried. So there's all sorts of pricing and value and strategic issues for Apple to grapple with over the next few months.
Well, one thing, though, John, that Apple TV Plus has over Disney, at least, doesn't have over Netflix or Hulu even, is episodic TV. I don't know how much episodic TV is in Disney Plus. But it's mostly movies, isn't it? Let's find out.
Good question.
Lineup. Let's see here. Variety says recent movie releases, Disney Plus originals, film series, short form content, documentaries.
Certainly with Marvel, they've got the Marvel TV series shows and along with.
Oh, you're right.
Yeah.
You're right about that. Yeah. And they've got the Clone Wars stuff. But that's. I don't know of how many new ongoing shows like Netflix has done and like Amazon Prime has done. And it, like, if anything, I would say that Apple TV Plus is more in line. Well, to your point, John, Apple doesn't have the back catalog that either Amazon or Netflix offers.
Mm-hmm.
And but they do, but it does seem like Apple is trying to put together the kind of quantity of new ongoing shows that one might associate with Amazon and Netflix.
Yeah, I don't think 30 projects is really enough.
Well, it's the first year.
Yeah, I think they're going to have
to. Netflix didn't have 30 projects in its first year, and neither did Amazon Prime.
I think they're going to have to do all three of the projects I defined. They're going to have to lower the price if you buy it by itself. Maybe don't let you buy it by itself, but maybe have a long free period and then roll it into a bundle and then buy a larger catalog. Apple's got a lot of work cut out for them. Disney, I think, basically outsmarted Apple and sized up Apple and looked at its portfolio and looked at what it was charging for its other subscriptions and said, Apple's in a weak position. We can really get a leg up. And the surveys, I've seen several surveys at a media news site, and almost all the surveys that I've read, have shown a remarkable percentage of people ready to sign up for Disney. And of course, there's that.
Well, I buy that.
There's that factor that you want to have a rich Disney library for your kids, and there is the signature movies, the animated movies from Disney that kids adore. And so, if you're going to be a parent, and you're going to have to just, you know, be under enormous pressure from your kids. Yeah. Well, Daddy, did you sign up for Disney Plus? Can we watch Frozen, please? Now.
So according to Variety, I think there's some 31 different TV series. Some of those at least are done, over and done with. Some of them are ongoing concerns. Includes The Simpsons. I think there are 4,256,927 episodes of The Simpsons. But, you know, DuckTales from 1987, DuckTales from 2016. Wicked Tuna, which is a show I think that was on Discovery. The Incredible Dr. Pole, which is on the Animal Planet cable network. And then a lot of Disney stuff and a lot of kids stuff like Raven's Home, That's So Raven, Mickey Mouse Shorts, Mickey Mouse Clubhouse. So there's actually not a whole lot of new ongoing TV stuff, especially aimed at adults.
Well, I wonder, now that you bring it up, I wonder if that includes ABC. Disney owns ABC, right?
Yes.
So yes, it does. As a matter of fact, so you have things like Once Upon a Time, which used to air on ABC.
Not listed. Hmm. That's a really good point, actually. I wonder where all that. I mean, it is the studio that's going to own a show, not necessarily the network that it was on. So, for instance, Disney is clearly producing Wicked Tuna, so they own it. Same thing with The Incredible Dr. Pole.
Right.
Here's another thing, John. I don't know. Let's say that everything that you're saying about Disney's pricing is accurate, and I think that there's a lot of wisdom behind it. I don't think it was just aimed at Apple. I think it might well have been aimed at anyone else thinking about getting into the space. Which is, you know, seems to be everybody.
Yeah. Well, I just read that
interesting.
NBC's pulling The Office out of Netflix and then bringing it over to Comcast, I guess.
To Comcast?
Comcast owns NBC Universal. I may have got that wrong, I'm seeing stuff getting pulled out of Netflix right and left because people want to, like the Marvel series, because providers want to have their own stuff with their own subscription service. And Netflix, I've seen articles that Netflix tries to put a good face on that, and they say, yeah, we saw that coming, and yeah, we've got a lot of original content, and that's why we did that. But it's still kind of like worries you in the back of your mind about how Netflix could devolve someday to, you know, only Netflix original content's left.
Right. Here's one more thought for this. How ironic is it that Steve's Pixar content is being weaponized against Apple?
Do you remember the days back in 2012, 13, where we all said Apple should buy Disney?
Yep.
I wonder how they feel about that now.
Yeah.
If Steve was on the board of directors, he could have made it happen.
He probably could have. Yeah. I mean, he couldn't have just like snapped his fingers, but I bet.
Well, there was that doofus CEO of Disney for the days of Bob Iger.
Yeah.
Do you remember his name? He shall remain nameless.
Idiot CEO Disney. No, he will not, because we want to.
So Disney was in a funk at that point. They hadn't acquired Pixar, and Pixar was blowing Disney animators out of the water with its content. And they had a doofus CEO, and Disney's vision and success wasn't as crisp as it is now. Disney was ripe for takeover.
Eisner, Michael Eisner.
Yeah.
That guy was a numbnut.
So, but the opportunity's gone. And now Apple's the new kid on the block trying to compete with some very experienced players.
Yeah, that is true.
And we've and this example of a Disney Plus pricing and library is a prime example of how smart studio executives have seen the weakness in Apple's game plan. Apple will recover, but you know the rosy-eyed days of Apple getting into the business and saying, I remember when Apple first announced Apple TV Plus, there were a smattering of articles I saw. You know, this is the end of Netflix. Apple's going to put Netflix out of business.
Yeah, that was ridiculous.
Yeah, I know.
No one should have said that.
I mean, they were written.
It is just as ridiculous as saying that Apple TV Plus will fail because of Netflix.
Yeah,
there is room for both. Apple will find subscribers to this stuff and will make money off of it.
One thing I have maintained though is that with all these studios getting into the subscription business, there will only be a few survivors. It's like the Democratic candidates. You know, where there's 23 Democratic candidates now, we know that in the summer of 2020 there will be one or two left. We know that in the summer of 2020 or 2021 there will only be three or four viable television subscription services left. The question is, are you going to be one of them? Is Netflix, Amazon, Hulu, Disney Plus, Apple TV Plus? Who's going to be the number one, number two, number three big player who captures all the money? And who's going to be the guys who are, you know, fighting for the crumbs?
I would say that Apple will be number five of those top five.
And then that raises the question, was Apple's ROI sufficient? Was the whole endeavor, the whole point of this, essential to Apple's business?
Yeah, because over time, I think that Apple should be able to claw additional market share as they continue to add shows, as they continue to build on what they have, as that arm of Apple gets bigger. You know, the question is whether or not Apple will let that happen.
Also, the question is how viewers will react to the content. Will they find it too Hallmarky, or will they find it gritty enough and quality enough to capture their imagination and keep them glued to their Apple TV sets?
That is a good question. All right, John. I think that we have a show. So first of all, let me play this bumper. And that's this week, Apple's Context Machine. I would like to thank John Martellaro for co-hosting this week.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Indeed. Thanks for being here. If you have anything out there in podcast land to comment on, add, or question, write me at acm@macobserver.com or join us over at macobserver.com/contextmachine. And again, that'll take you to our Facebook group. Our content is written by the staff at TMO, and our bandwidth is provided by CashFly. The bass is by Boom, recorded for TMO, and that is all for this week.